Hi, and welcome to Mouse Chat for Friday, January 27th, 2012. I'm Lisa, and joining us today we have Steve. Steve has returned. Welcome. And we'll have Bob, Chris, and Lauren. And we have a very special guest today. And welcome to Len Testa.
Thanks.
Welcome, everyone.
Thank you guys for having me.
Chris, do you want to jump in and tell us who Len is?
So Len Testa is sort of like the ultimate Disney guy. He's the co-author of The Unofficial Guide, the developer of touring plans and lines, which I think a lot of people have on their phones, and it gives you wait times in the park. There's a chat feature where you can ask questions. This is very useful.
You could let him say all that.
Did you want me to let him say that?
No, you did well.
No, that's okay. Fine.
What makes up the ultimate Disney guy, Chris?
You know, just somebody who's like a hardcore geek.
Soft eyes. I do have a Mickey Mouse tattoo if you wanted to.
Well, two out of three, and I'm there.
Well, do you know what I'm saying, though? you know, like you have fans, and then you have, you know, people who are like hardcore fans, like Len Testa.
It's true. I turned it into a career. That's actually.
I know.
That's the fun part.
Best job ever.
That's the best part.
Don't rub it in.
Yeah, I get paid to go to Disney World, folks. It's true.
Yeah, but do you still have to pay $18 for a pretzel?
Yeah, we pay retail for everything. We pay for every single thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we get the same discounts that you guys do, but there's no Len Testa discount at the hotels or anything like that.
Wait a minute. They told me there was.
No, it's true.
Oh, so we can't name drop now?
No. Lou Mangiello, actually. I say I'm Lou Mangiello a lot.
Okay.
Does that work out?
No, not even once. It's embarrassing, actually.
Is that when they pull up your record?
I have the best Mike Newell story there. You guys know Mike from our show, right?
Yes.
So last December, Mike managed to get Le Cellier reservations 5 nights in a row.
Oh, my gosh.
For party of four. And he gave away the first 4 nights because he didn't want to go 5 times. So four nights in a row, a different group of people came up and said, "Hi, I'm Mike Newell," and ate. And it just so happened that the same cast member seated all four of them. So when we went on the fifth night, then Mike went on the fifth night, they actually asked for ID because they didn't believe it was him. four times, great. Like, okay, you're Mike Newell. Then the fifth time, I'm like, no, here's my driver's license. I'm Mike Newell. It was great.
Funny.
Can you tell us how you got started? I know you have sort of a computer background. How did you get started doing this? And then I would really love to know, you know, how you get your information, how you put it together.
Okay. So
husband's a statistician, so I have to ask that question.
Not a problem at all. So I was reading an official guide one day in the mid-1990s. I was going on a trip to Walt Disney World with my sister, reading the unofficial guide, and I thought it was a fantastic book. We went down to Walt Disney World, and I was standing in line for the Great Movie Ride back when it was popular. Mm-hmm. You guys remember those days, right? Maybe you're too young. But it used to be a popular ride, and I was actually standing outside in the sun for like 2 hours waiting to ride the Great Movie Ride. And I thought to myself, there's got to be a better way to do this. So I was just finishing up my undergraduate degree in computer science, and I went to my the professors who would be my thesis advisors for my master's degree, and I said, you know, what if we came up with a computer program that minimized your wait time in line at Disney World? So, you know, you tell it the attractions you want to ride. It tells you the order in which you should ride them to minimize your wait in line. So they sent me off to do some research, and it turns out it's an extremely complicated scheduling problem to do that. And there's a lot of literature written about it. It turns out it's actually almost the exact same problem that UPS and FedEx face every day when they try and deliver packages as cheaply as possible. So if you're if you think about like UPS or FedEx, you've got all these customers that you want to visit, right? And you want to visit them as cheaply as possible. So that means it's a combination of the driver's time and the gas that you spend, right, driving the truck. The interesting thing is that the travel time between any two customers isn't necessarily dependent on just the distance. It's also the time of day that you go. You guys have all experienced this too. If you're on like a highway and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, generally it's not that crowded. But if you're on the same highway at 5 p.m. during rush hour, you travel much slower. So it turns out that there's UPS and FedEx and other companies in the in this area have come up with techniques for solving these kinds of problems. So my thesis looked at those, looked at a couple of other techniques, and then came up with a new way of solving that kind of problem. So that was my thesis. And in the course of doing the work, I wrote a letter to Bob, I think he was authoring the book at the time, and I said, "Hey, I've got this computer program that I've worked on. Do you have any data? Like, I don't know how long the wait times are at Space Mountain at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but if you could tell me that, it'd be great." And it turns out he didn't actually have that kind of data in the way that we needed it, but he was very helpful in providing suggestions about things. I remember we actually had a phone call one time talking about the travel time between the shore and the island of Tom Sawyer Island. Like, how long does it really take to cross on the raft? It was an entire phone conversation. It was great. But so we didn't have the right data, but we ended up talking, and over time he gave me lots of pointers. Then I ended up having to go get the data, which was a whole other story. But that's how we got started.
So, how much research, I guess, goes into, putting together those touring plans? I mean, I've heard, and I'm sure that it's constantly got to be updated and tested and made sure that you're, constantly giving, accurate information in these plans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. So, we collect data in every park every day of the year. And generally, we have data for every attraction, for every park, for every day of the year. And that's going back through – now, some of the data we have goes back to, the late 1990s, early 2000s. Generally, we rely on the more recent data for things. But occasionally, we'll pull out the wait time data that we have from, Christmas 2001 just to see how it compares to Christmas, 2011, just to see what happens. We have many hundreds of thousands of pieces of data from the parks, and we have statisticians that analyze it. It's actually automatically analyzed every night now because we're programmers and we're statisticians. Every piece of data we get is analyzed every 5 minutes to update the wait time estimates that we have.
Now that I find impressive.
I was going to say that is very impressive.
There's a lot of computing power that goes into the site. So when you enter a wait time in lines, like if you're standing in front of Space Mountain, within 5 minutes, the entire site will be updated with that piece of information. All of our historical estimates will know about it. All of our future estimates will know about it every 5 minutes.
Now, how has having lines changed what you do? Has it impacted it at all?
It's really interesting. We have a lot more data, which is really good. There were some interesting things about the use of lines that we didn't anticipate, and I think it probably would have been hard to anticipate until you got there, until you actually had it. So, like, one thing is, some people, it was hard for us to tell originally. Who was entering data from the attraction and who was entering data wait times from the tip boards, because they're often two different times.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting because when you go back and analyze the data, you can see in lines something like this. Somebody will enter a wait time of 30 minutes for Space Mountain, and literally within 60 seconds, somebody will enter another wait time of 45 minutes for Space Mountain. And then 30 seconds later, someone will enter another wait time of 30 minutes for Space Mountain. So it'll be 30, 45, 30. Which one is right? Well, it depends, right? So the thing that we try to look for then is somebody entering from the tip board. So how do you know that somebody's entering it from the tip board?
You would see them enter, like they'd have one for Test Track and Soarin' right next to each other.
That's exactly right. So we look for things like that, and we tend to segment those things differently. The posted wait times from the attraction and posted wait times from tip ports are treated differently. We're not saying either of them are wrong. They're just different things, and they mean different things. But there's
one isn't more useful than the other.
They both have their uses. The thing that we really look for is actual standby wait times. So one of the features that we added to lines that we're promoting a lot lately is a timer that you can start when you get in line and turn off just as you're boarding the ride that tells you the actual wait time. One of the things that we're really interested in, and I think that makes lines unique, is we don't estimate the posted wait time you see outside. We estimate the time you will actually spend in line. And that's something I think we're
that's
the only ones that do that. Yeah, so at the end of the day, I don't really care whether Disney's posted wait time is 30 or 40 minutes, especially when you consider it's probably a teenager making minimum wage that's setting that time, and most of the time it's not that accurate.
Well, and don't they inflate their time so that you feel better when your 45-minute wait took you only 30 minutes?
That's like the popular legend, and it may be like a goal for them to do that, but if you compare the actual wait time to the posted wait times, it's not as clear-cut as saying, yeah, they always inflate the wait times. Like the rule that we've heard was that the actual wait time is supposed to be 80% of the posted wait time. So if the posted wait time is 40 minutes, you'll actually wait 32, right? It turns out that's not the case virtually at any time of the day. It doesn't even average out to that. So I don't know if this is like a legend or it's just – it's something that, you know, maybe they strive for and they just don't hit. But it's really interesting to see how they overestimate and underestimate the wait times. So that's one of the things that we do. Here's an interesting fact. I was just before this call, I was talking to our statistician Fred, and we're always looking for ways to make to communicate to our users two things: one, what we think Disney's posted wait time is going to be, and then two, what the actual wait time is, right? So when you're using lines, right, especially if you're a first-time user of lines, and we say the wait for Space Mountain is going to be 25 minutes, right? It might be 25 minutes, and we might know internally that Disney's estimating a 60-minute or posting a 60-minute wait, but we think it's still going to be 25. But still, when you walk up there, right, and you've never been to Walt Disney World before, and we're telling you 25, and the guy from Disney's telling you 60, it's, you know, there's a trust issue there, right? You have to believe us more than you believe them, right?
Sure.
And for a lot of first-time users, it's hard for them to do that. So one of the interesting things that Fred did, and I think this was very clever, is he plotted the frequency at which Disney posts various wait times for Toy Story Mania. So Toy Story Mania is very popular, right? Wait times could be 120 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. But at the beginning of the day, it starts off and it's like 5 or 10 minutes, right?
I've never seen single digits.
I know, right? I know.
Wait, maybe they actually have a 5 minute?
I know, right? Maybe the bottom is 15, right? Maybe you know, it's like the opposite of amplifiers that go to 11. This thing only goes down to 15, whatever, right? So one of the things that Fred did is he said, how many times throughout the year has Disney posted a wait time of 120 minutes at Toy Story Mania? And how many times have they posted 115? And how many times have they posted 110, 105, 100, and so on? And here's the interesting thing. More than 80% of the posted wait times at Toy Story Mania are one of like six different times. So it's either like 30, 60, 90, 105, or 120. There's never apparently a 110-minute wait for Toy Story Mania, right? Now, as statisticians, right, as people who deal with numbers on a regular basis, we know that if you're going from
law of averages,
105 to 120, at some point there was actually a 110-minute wait, right? It's not like a Brazilian tour group gets in line at exactly the right time at the exact same point of time every single day to make it go from 105. Yeah, maybe
that's funny, because I was thinking that when you were talking Space Mountain, that, you know, that could be the big difference between that 30-minute and that 45-minute.
So Fred and I have this theory that, like, there's this table with like pre-printed signs on it that say, like, you know, 30, 45, 60, 95, 110. And, you know, like when you guys are putting clothes away at home, you tend to wear the clothes that are on top of the pile first, or you tend to grab the dishes that are on the top of the stack of plates when you want to eat dinner, right? You just grab the first thing on top of the pile. I swear the guys at Toy Story Mania, they're just picking whatever number is close and on top of the pile. And they're flipping that up to the guy that changes the sign and says, put this one up. That's it.
Ultimate laziness.
Yeah, you'll never see like a 70-minute wait or a 40-minute wait at Toy Story Mania. It's always going to be one of like eight different numbers.
And I know they do the testing with the, you know, they give out those lanyards now with the little red card.
Well, here's how you, yeah. Yeah, they do. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. So think about how that process works, right? Suppose you get in line at 3 o'clock and they give you a red card, right?
Okay.
And it takes you 40 minutes to get through Space Mountain, right? So at 3:40, you hand your red card off, right? What do they do with that then?
I assume that they use that to change the time. Like, okay, it took 40 minutes.
They just hang it on a post.
But the problem is that it's 40 minutes later. By the time
it's
40
minutes late. It's a lagging indicator.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we did last year with Space Mountain is we posted we actually had people ride Space Mountain literally over and over again all day, several days in a row. So we got like 8 volunteers, not volunteers, we paid them, but we got them to ride Space Mountain and we got them to get in line every 15 minutes from the time the park opened to the time the park closed. And they plotted their actual wait time. And then we plotted the posted wait time against that. And the funniest thing is if you look at the actual wait time, right, and then you took the posted wait time on a graph, the posted wait time is a little bit more distorted because they didn't get it exactly right, but it shifted almost an hour to the right. Which means
that the delayed reaction.
Exactly. Yeah, they it's like, you know, when they posted a 60-minute wait at 2 o'clock, well, that was the wait an hour ago at 1 o'clock.
Now it's only 15 minutes.
I know. Yeah, because
everyone's eating lunch now.
People go get in line for the parade.
3 o'clock parade.
Yeah, it's hysterical.
Len,
I have a question. I want to get a job being the person that rides Space Mountain.
You so don't want to get that job because
I do.
No, you don't actually.
Because technically, couldn't you just get in line and then skip the ride and then get out of line?
Yeah, you could.
Because you're just testing the line.
And I think some people did that, but I think most people rode. And the reason why I say most people rode is because they all complained of like neck and back problems for like a week afterward. Like no one in that little group ever wants to ride Space Mountain again. We had a bunch of fast passes on New Year's Eve for Space Mountain, and I was with my team and everything, and everyone was like, "Nah, send the kids. I don't want to go," because they'd all been on it like 60 times in the last month or whatever.
Well, they still fared better than the people you had test. It's a small world over and over again.
they're in the loony bin now.
Right there. Yeah.
Of all the things you want to test, right? The one that actually gets the most requests is the people who do the hotel testing. But that's that actually goes to senior people. Yeah, you have to work your way.
How do we get on your staff?
Yeah, really.
Wait. I'm the closest to Orlando. I'm the one relocating.
I'll move to Orlando.
If anybody should get a job, it's the guy in Florida.
Yeah, but who has 3 unofficial guides sitting in their bookcase? Me.
I have one.
And a small shrine.
Yeah, it's
kind of
kind of creepy.
I'm
Chris.
Telling you, the unofficial guide is like
stalking you.
Yeah, it's true. No, seriously, the unofficial guide, it's like the best thing ever. So if that's not your Disney Bible, you're just crazy.
It's the best-selling travel book in the world. Did you know that?
Is it really?
Yes, not for just Disney. It's the best-selling travel book of any kind in the world.
What percentage, though, of Disney guests use it, though? Because I remember reading or hearing something that it wasn't as high as you would think.
It's like 1%, maybe a little less.
What do you think? You'd think it'd be higher.
I hope it would be higher just, because we make money on it. But, the funny thing to me is, like, the number of people who are willing to drop $5,000 on a vacation.
Right.
Absolutely no planning. Like,
yes.
Who spends $5,000 and doesn't do any research? That's
true.
They just figure
the magic will fall in their lap. Especially, and I have a neighbor. She went last year and she was planning something. And I said, here, take this. And it was like a 2009 unofficial guide. It was an old one, obviously. And I'm like, you can have this. And she looked at me like I handed her a dead rat. She was like, what do you want me to do with this? This is huge. I'm like, no, this will help you out. I don't think she read it. And I think she was just willing to sort of go there and spend her money, and she didn't care.
But you miss out on so much when you do it that way.
Yeah, so Len, why don't you tell our listeners? Why should somebody pick up the unofficial guide or use touring plans? What's going to be the ultimate benefit to them? Because sometimes we say that over and over, and I don't know if people believe us.
There's a couple of things. You can definitely go to Walt Disney World and not use any guidebook, show up and have a great time. The guide appeals to people who want to make the most of their time and money. So if you're interested in getting a good deal on a hotel or a car rental, we outline specific strategies for how to do that, and we rate the hotels so you know that you're not spending your money on a bad hotel. Same thing for restaurants. We, you know, we did every restaurant in Walt Disney World. Actually, I've eaten in literally every single restaurant in Walt Disney World, every food cart, every counter service restaurant, every sit down restaurant, except the new AMC Dine-In.
Wow, yes,
that's not bad. So we in terms of the touring plans, you know, we're there to make sure that you don't wait in line any longer than you have to. So for us, it's the difference between, you know, seeing 10 attractions in a day or seeing 20 attractions in a day. And really, since the theme parks are the focus for most people, seeing 20 attractions in the time that most people see 10 is generally viewed as a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah.
I guess the only reason I've never done a touring plan is because I have a feeling that it's just going to be too rigid. Because I like to plan my day like, okay, we're going to go to Epcot on this day and Magic Kingdom on this day. But then I know sort of the attractions I want to see and what I want to do. But if, you know, there's some street entertainers or a snack or, you know, the kids want to take a nap, I don't want to feel like I'm stuck to a schedule or I'm going to miss some of the things that just happen naturally.
So there's two things I would say to that. Number one is, generally speaking, for most people, if you're doing a comprehensive tour, it's the five or six attractions in the morning that are critical. You know, if you've got kids and you're going to the Magic Kingdom, you really do have to get Dumbo out of the way first. Otherwise, it's all, you know. So what we tell people is, especially people who are scared about sticking to a schedule, really it's the first five or six attractions. You get through that, and that's most of the bottlenecks in a given day. And then after that, you can kind of relax and see where you're going. If you want, you know, and five or six attractions are really from like, you know, 9 to maybe 10:30 or 11 o'clock in the morning. After that, you can take it easier. But we realize that, you know, people want to take unscheduled breaks or they see street performers or anything. So, you know, we've always grappled with this on the technology side, that you've got this touring plan, right? And, you know, as much work that goes into them and as much research as we can do, it's still, you know, a touring plan in a book. And, you know, attractions break down, Brazilian tour groups jump in front of you, it rains, your kid wants to ride Haunted Mansion twice, you know, what do you do then, right? Because the plan can't compensate for that. So we came up with...
We can't stray from the plan.
Well, so here's the interesting thing. Have you guys seen in Lines we introduced on-the-fly computer-optimized touring plans for your mobile phone?
Yes, and I read a little bit about that, but I kind of want to hear from you, and I think everybody else probably wants to know more about it because I thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, so it's designed to you're supposed to bring with you in the park. It's part of Lines, our mobile application. It's completely free. Anyone can use it. You do have to sign up for a free subscription on our site for that, and the reason is obviously it's your touring plan, and we have to have a way of identifying you and the touring plan, but it's free. So you create a touring plan before you go. You know, pick out the attractions you want, and you optimize it, and we'll give you an initial schedule. And then when you get to the park, we'll give you a checklist, you know, like 1 to 20 or whatever it is you want to do. And as you go through the park and you go through the attractions, you can mark off on your phone, you know, that you've done these attractions. And if you want to add new attractions, there's a way to add new attractions. Like, let's say you go on Haunted Mansion, and you get off of it, and your kids are just crazy about it, and they want to ride it again. Well, just, you know, I'll modify the plan, add one more Haunted Mansion, and there's a little re-optimize button on the touring plan, and it'll, if you hit it, it'll actually recompute your touring plan based on everything you've done, everything you have left to do, and where you're at in the park right now, plus all the wait times in the park that people have entered in lines. So
it's
literally,
like a GPS.
It is. It's GPS for theme parks. That's exactly what it is.
And it's got a detour.
It is. So you can take breaks. You know, here's the thing, right? Suppose instead of getting coming off of Haunted Mansion, and instead of riding it again, everyone just decides they need a 20-minute ice cream break. Go get the ice cream for 20 minutes, and then when you're done, hit the optimize button again, and it'll figure out, you know, 20 minutes later, from where you're at in the park, what you should do next. So no matter where you are in the park, no matter what just happened, when you hit the optimize button, it'll tell you how to minimize your wait in line from that point forward for the rest
like
of the day.
Like a refresh.
It is. It's
that's pretty cool.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Steve, we need to go in February and we need to try this.
Yeah, we haven't tried it. We've done it kind of every way. We worked there as cast members years ago, and then we went, you know, before we got married, then we went as a married couple, now we go with kids. And we've been on the ride so many times that it's, well, now it's more about the rides for the kids, but, you know, sometimes it's just we'll ride one or two things and it's just about being there and doing the little things. But it'd still be interesting to see how it works out and what we could get in and how we can optimize it. And
we think we're pretty slick.
But if you want to try it, you know, what we can do is we can get a touring plan and you guys can figure it out too. One of the things that we periodically do is we take a touring plan and we'll give it to people who are experts in the theme parks, so locals, and we'll tell them, I don't care how you do it. Like, you know, you can get as many fast passes as you want. You can run around the park and scout wait times. I don't care how you do it. Here are 20 rides that we want you to ride. I don't care the order in which you do it. Go do it. And then we'll give somebody a touring plan that's computer optimized with the same 20 attractions, and we'll see who finishes first. We've never had the touring plan has never been beat. The software has never been beat. The closest anyone's come is 45 minutes. And it was a group of four, and they did actually split up in the park and essentially run around every hour or so and look at all the wait times, then try and figure out where to go next and try and run around
texting
and get fast passes.
Everyone and
yeah, but I mean, you're not going to do that as a family, but it was an interesting, it was an interesting idea.
Now, let me ask, can I ask you a question that optimized for the phone? Is that, do you download that on your touring plans website?
It's in Lines. So it's you can get it on the
it's part of the app.
Yeah, so you get it from the App Store and iTunes. You get it from the Android Marketplace.
Got it. Because I have the Lines app.
Yeah, and if you have a phone that that doesn't have like an App Store, you can always go to mlikemobile.touringplans.com, and that's Lines as well. It's web based, so you don't need an app. Oh. You could do it from any web enabled phone.
Very cool. I think a lot of people also question with touring plans, well, does it work, you know, every day of the year? Like, surely this couldn't work on Easter or New Year's Eve when there's, you know, 80,000 people in the park, but it does.
So we actually do a touring plan. The last 2 years we've done the adult one-day touring plan for holidays on New Year's Eve in the parks. So in New Year's Eve 2010 and New Year's Eve 2011, we did the touring plan. So you start obviously at 6:45 in the morning, which is when the park opens. But in 2010, we did – so there are 32 steps in the plan. We rode 35 rides. We actually got to ride some things over by 5 p.m. on New Year's Eve, the busiest day of the year. It was the busiest day in all of 2010. We rode 35 things, and then we just decided to be done for the day because it was 5 o'clock, and everyone started to get tired. But we literally rode every single thing we wanted to see. We had tons of fast passes left over. You know, we sat, we ate lunch, we recharged our iPhones. We were done by 5 o'clock. Completely doable.
It's just amazing. I mean, so, you know, obviously you have competition. You know, you came up with this idea, and you know, there are other companies out there now who tout, you know, that they have touring plans. So, I mean, what makes you so different from these guys? I mean, clearly the optimized features, I think, something that nobody else has.
Yeah, so lots of people have touring plans. We, but none of them are actually, maybe with one exception, maybe with RideMax's exception, no one actually touts that they, that their goal of their touring plans are to save time. Obviously, we test our touring plans against everyone else's touring plans head to head all the time. Nobody's really close. And I think most people will tell you, especially people who write guidebooks and have touring plans, they will go out of their way to say, we're not competing on a saving you time in line basis. They'll try and find some other angle.
Right.
And I think, you know, like, you know, this is the most relaxing way, and, you know, and it's hard to quantify relaxing, or it's the most fun way to see the Magic Kingdom, because, you know, who knows what that means. But in terms of saving time, I think most people realize that they're not going to come close. And it's really hard for, you know, for travel writers to find the technology to do that. I mean, it was my master's degree. There aren't that many people that are doing it, right?
No. No, so, I that would say that's a very creative thesis that you came up with. Yeah.
Yeah. So most people that have touring plans don't compete on time. They you know, and if they do, I know there are a couple of people that do. I mean, we've tested ours against theirs over and over again, and no one's really that close.
Now, it's mostly Disney World, or the focus is Disney World, but you do have a Disneyland product, right?
Yeah, we do, the unofficial guide to Disneyland. It's actually the best-selling guide to Disneyland as well. And then we have Disneyland on Lines as well. So we've got touring plans. We've got a crowd calendar for that. We've got obviously all the dining information and hotel information and attraction information on as well. The optimized touring plans for Disneyland should come out in a couple of weeks. We're still testing it.
Okay, I have an off-the-wall question.
Good.
I would like to know how many days out of the year do you spend in a Disney park?
That's a good question.
I was talking to somebody about this. So,
and then after that, we'll expand it to Disney property.
So in a Disney park, you know, I lost count back in the late 90s with how many trips I've had. But I once calculated that if I kept up my regular pace, whatever that is, so it's like, you know, once a month or so in a park for a few days, I would by the if I lived to be like 72, I would spend 2% of my life in a Disney theme park.
Do you ever get sick of it? You know, I mean, because Bob and I actually go quite a bit, and you know, do you just? I never get tired of it, but I don't go as much as you, obviously. Do you ever just get like I'm here again? Yay, a monorail.
No, I mean, we actually talked about this on my podcast on Monday. I still get excited riding the monorail to into the Magic Kingdom. I still think it's the coolest thing ever. I still remember, like, when I'm going through the Contemporary, I still remember riding the monorail as a kid and thinking, you know, my God, what kind of people stay at the Contemporary? Mm-hmm, have to be, you know. And now, I mean, I could stay there, you know, any night I wanted to, and I have. I mean, I've stayed there, but you know, it's something very special to me. The thing that amazes me still about Disney, I mean, for all its faults, and is they still have the best theme park product. And if you think about the size of the thing that they do, right? I mean, it's a town, right? It's a city, 100,000 people at any given time, 60,000 employees. Yeah, they still pull it off really, really well. I mean, you could look at individual parts of it and say, you know, why do they do this or why do they do that? But if you look at it from their perspective, you totally understand why they do most things.
Right.
So, yeah, they still pull it off pretty well. Do I wish that they had, you know, slightly better rides? Yeah. Do I, you know, as a shareholder, would I want them to be investing $500 million a year in new rides? Probably not. You know, I kind of get it.
So, not to change the subject, but what do you think about Avatar Land? I guess it's not called that, but you know what I'm saying.
I saw the movie once.
That sounds
I
like
still
the
haven't
rest
seen
of
the movie.
Yeah, no one's thrilled about that.
I, you know, from a visual perspective, just, you know, not thinking about story, just thinking about visuals and sort of the message, I get it. Totally get it. How they're going to pull that off, you know, in a way that doesn't look, excuse the language, half-assed, right. I got to see that. I don't know. You know, it could be, the only thing that, I talked to Jim Hill about this. You guys know Jim?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we've had him on the show.
So Jim and I did a podcast, actually. It's an unofficial guide podcast. It's on iTunes, where we walked through the Animal Kingdom and talked about it. Jim's opinion of this is that the only thing that's going to keep Disney from cheaping out on it is the fact that James Cameron is so insane that and so hard-assed about it all that he will force them to spend the money. And that's what they have to go from. It's going to come down to execution, you know, like most things. I think Mr. Toad's Wild Ride is a great ride. They probably did not spend $200 million developing that, you know. So there's you could do great things with inexpensive rides. You know, I hope that they put the thought into it, you know, to make it worthwhile. Because they could do something really amazing with that.
What are your thoughts on the Fantasyland expansion? I know you touched on that a little bit the other day during your talk. And I asked you what you thought about when Little Mermaid would open. And, of course, you made me sad by saying December. What do you think about the Fantasyland expansion?
The interesting thing about Fantasyland and the Magic Kingdom prior to this was how small that Fantasyland was compared to the Fantasylands in every other park. Like in Disneyland, Fantasyland is essentially the core, the center, you know, the emotional center of the park, Fantasyland, right? In Disneyland Paris, Fantasyland is huge. In the Magic Kingdom, it's not. It was sort of, you know, a thin sort of ribbon around the back of the park, especially when after Toontown opened and when 20,000 Leagues closed, there really wasn't a lot to Fantasyland. So it's nice that they brought it back to be sort of the centerpiece, you know, of the Magic Kingdom. It's, you know, now I think it's geographically it's the largest area. Maybe with Jungle Cruise it's not, but it's very close to being the largest. And in terms of like the splashiest new attractions, it's definitely Fantasyland. The interesting thing from my perspective is, you know, I don't look at Little Mermaid as being an e-ticket ride. Have you guys been on it in Disneyland?
Yeah.
Yeah, Lisa and I have been on it a few times.
What'd you think of it?
I mean, it's a dark ride that's, you know, done nicely for, you know, nowadays as opposed to the ones that they have at Fantasyland now. So it's kind of like a Winnie the Pooh type attraction.
It's like a Nemo ride.
Or kind
of
like Nemo.
It reminds me of the clamshells.
No one thinks it's like, you know, it's not the same thing as Harry Potter, right? And I think Disney,
Disney
originally was hyping it to that level. It's not a Harry Potter type ride. It's a good like, you know, B minus, maybe C ticket ride. The good thing about it though is since it's an Omnimover, it's going to suck up, you know, 2,400 people an hour, right? Which is what they need for Fantasyland. You know, the Dumbo thing, they're doubling the capacity with Dumbo. I don't know what else they're going to do in Storybook Circus Land other than maybe the Great Goofini, which is essentially the same ride that it was. For me, the two interesting things are going to be, one, the Seven Dwarves Mine Train, which has the potential to be the sleeper hit. If I'm going to pick the fun ride, the ride that people go on because they want to, not because there's no wait, it's going to be Seven Dwarves Mine Train. I think that has the potential to be a lot of fun.
Yep.
And it's supposed to be something, according to the Imagineers, it's supposed to be something between the Great Goofini and Big Thunder Mountain. It's supposed to be like, you know, if your kids can do the Great Goofini, but they don't want to go on Big Thunder, Seven Dwarfs Mine Train is the thing that's in the middle for them. So it's sort of like a progression thing in the eyes of the Imagineers. First you do the Goofini, you get comfortable with that. Then when you're a little older, you go on Seven Dwarfs Mine Train. And then once you've mastered that, you can sort of step up to the bigger, you know, the actual true Disney roller coasters. That's going to be interesting to see how they run that, like what the capacity is, what kind of theming they put into it, and how they build up around it. The other interesting thing about that is if you think about where they're putting that, that's really the middle of the new expansion area for Fantasyland, right?
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how are you going to get from one end of Fantasyland to the other if that's in the middle?
It's going to be like California Adventure. You're going to have like a giant wall around it till it's done.
So there's got to be, I actually ran the Disneyland marathon, half marathon this year, September last year, through DCA with the walls. That was interesting. But so the thing about that is you're either going to have to go above it and behind it, right? Behind Seven Dwarfs Mine Train, or you're going to have to go below it, kind of where Mrs. Potts is, you know, today in the in World. That's from a traffic flow perspective. That's going to be interesting because if you go sort of in the back, you're kind of going towards where Storytime with Belle is going to be. It's sort of the Belle's Village. And I don't know that they want to push that many people back there because it doesn't look like it's built for that and it's a dead end. So from a traffic flow perspective, how they work around the flow around that, you know, the fast pass return stuff, how they do all of that is interesting for Seven Dwarfs. Mm-hmm. The thing I'm really interested though is the food at Gaston's, because I think that is the potential to be, you know, insanely popular.
I'm excited about a new restaurant in Magic Kingdom.
So it's sort of what they have envisioned for what they kind of did with the Cantina and La Hacienda at Epcot, where it's a combination counter service full service.
Yeah,
and it's supposed to be much more elaborate. Yeah, I'm excited though. So you know the characters are going to come alive at night. If it's a traditional character meal, I don't think that's going to be fun. My sense is it's going to be something like Turtle Talk with Crush.
That's what we've basically been told. We've been told there will not be any, you know, characters there.
No,
it'll be, you know, there's not going to be like Belle walking around or something.
No, it'll be more, you know, Turtle Talky.
Turtle Talky. I like that. Turtle Talky. that's cool. And honestly, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you said. I mean, as far as Fantasyland gets so crowded, especially in the afternoon. I mean, with all those strollers and things. So,
yep.
I mean,
and
if it opens
terrible
up
strollers. Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, if it opens up that whole area, I mean, it's probably going to, it sounds like it might mess with your touring plans for a while there. You know, I'm sure it's going to change.
It's just a challenge.
Things. Yeah.
We're already starting to model the attractions, the wait times and the walking times and stuff like that, just to kind of get an idea of what it's going to do. Yeah. But I think, Dumbo's capacity is doubling. Mermaid, we think, you know, you'll still have to go see Dumbo first thing in the morning, but we're thinking like Seven Dwarfs Mine Train might literally be the second thing that you see in a day. The interesting thing is it's actually going to decrease the demand for Peter Pan and Winnie the Pooh.
Oh,
so
okay.
It might be Dumbo, Seven Dwarfs, Pan, Pooh, or it might be, you know, depending on how the numbers work out, Dumbo, Seven Dwarves, Pan, you know, counterclockwise through the rest of the park, come back and see the rest of Fantasyland later. Because, you know, in the afternoon, there's, you know, after the initial rush subsides, right, after the initial opening hubbub is all dies down, it's going to be just like Mermaid just at World is going to be pretty much like World Mermaid at Disneyland, where, you know, in the afternoon there's a 5 or 10 minute wait to get on. It's going to be like that too. I mean, it's going to get through 2,400 people an hour. That's pretty much everybody who wants to ride, you know, on most days.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so we'll see.
That'll be nice.
Yeah, they're not going to have Fastpass for Mermaid, and that's one of the reasons why it's going to be able to handle so many people. That's why Fastpass never worked on Mansion. So many people can ride it, really, when you need to wait.
What about touring plans for other parks? Is there just not the market for it? For Universal Studios with Harry Potter or SeaWorld?
Yeah, we get requests for them. I mean, Universal, obviously, we have touring plans in the book for Universal. They're not yet on the site. We get requests for them, just not as many as we do for, you know, different feature requests for World. In terms of the other parks, really, once you've covered Universal and you've covered the Disney parks, you've really got the top 10. We did do a book last year for British theme parks. And I did. I actually went to England for a month, 2 years in a row, and covered the top 5 British theme parks. And that was a hoot. That was a lot of fun. So I went to. I got to go to England for a total of like 8 weeks.
Nice.
So we got touring plans for those as well. And one of them is Legoland, and they just opened up a Legoland in Florida. Rides are almost exactly the same too.
Yeah, Bob went for the press event for Legoland.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it looks like they put on a the attractions are pretty solid. I mean, it's a good little park. You know, it's a good, you know, 3/4 of a day.
Yeah, I mean, I think kids definitely get a lot more out of it than adults. And I realize that kids are, you know, ages 2 to 12 are their core market. But, you know, it's just, you know, when an adult is being forced to pay $75, $80 to get in, you know, that's expensive, but their annual pass sales have been very solid the first 3 months, and I mean, they announced today plans for their water park, so you know they're not slowing down. So I mean, I'm glad something's in that space. That's something that looks like it's actually going to last.
Yeah, they're what, like 45 minutes north of Orlando. The 45 minute thing.
It's closer to an hour. Yeah, when I drove it, yeah, it's closer to an hour.
Yeah, that's be the one thing I would be concerned about. Not that they couldn't, you know, make it work. It's not that many people are going to drive an hour out of the way on their vacation.
Oh, exactly. And I mean, they've even come out and said, you know, we're kind of relying a lot on, you know, people from Orlando and Tampa to make up the bulk of our business. But surprisingly, they say their numbers so far with you know, out-of-town guests has been, substantial. But that could just be because it's, you know, they're new and that, you know, people want to check them out.
Okay. Can I ask a question that's kind of like not a touring plans or unofficial guide? Like, kind of is an unofficial guide question.
Sure.
We get asked all the time, what is the best, cheapest place to stay offsite? And I can never really give an answer because I'm afraid to send someone someplace seedy. Do you have a favorite?
Because we know you stay a lot of places. Yeah. So I've stayed at almost $50. Super 8 on 192. The Super 8 that's closest to Walt Disney World is actually clean. You know, I mean, $50 a night. It's clean enough. It's safe. You know, you don't feel bad. It's that or the Masters Inn in Kissimmee. Actually, it's right next to an Indian restaurant.
I know exactly where that is.
Yeah. So it looks on the outside, it looks like one of those places where, like, ooh, I don't know if I'd stay there. But actually, the rooms are clean. The staff is very friendly. And yeah, I've never felt unsafe there. You know, you get farther down 192, like, you know, there are a couple places where you have to literally go a couple more miles down 192 where you kind of lose. It starts to get a lot more rural. I don't know that I would stay that far away.
Right.
But the Super 8, not bad at all, and the Masters Inn, not bad at all. There's also a La Quinta on International Drive. It's a little more expensive. It's like 70 a night.
Okay.
But fabulous. The only thing you have to watch out for there is road traffic noise. It's kind of bad. But I bring a white noise generating machine with me. Actually, it's an app on my iPhone. But that works.
Okay. Thank you.
And then, you know, depending on how much more money you want to spend, it could be.
Yeah, I want to hear some more categories.
So I was just for under $150, so around $140 a night. The Hilton Bonnet Creek is fabulous. Have you guys stayed there?
No.
We keep hearing that's really nice, though.
Dude,
but Bob, you stayed at the Waldorf Astoria, right?
Yeah.
Which is right next door.
And they share the same facilities, I guess.
Yeah, they have the same parking garage. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you know, they force you to valet at the Waldorf. Yeah.
They do. You can park and walk. I mean, they kind of look at you funny if you're walking up with your luggage. But so the Hilton has a 3-acre lazy river on it. I mean, it's every bit as good as the pool at Yacht and Beach Club. It's phenomenal. The rooms are really nice. The bathrooms are you know, good. They're not great. They're not. The Waldorf actually has the much better bathrooms. So the Hilton Bonnet Creek, not bad in terms of bathrooms. And overall, I mean, the beds are very comfortable. Climate control, the AC works. The TV's good. It's a nice solid resort. And again, for $138, I think it's better than the Swan and Dolphin. You don't get the extra magic hour privileges, but you know, if that's not your thing, then for $138, I think it's a great deal. The Waldorf, if you can get it under $200 a night, is a steal. I said this actually to Christina at the talk this last Saturday. I would rather stay in the bathroom at the Waldorf Astoria than I would at Pop Century. The bathroom is that nice at the Waldorf?
No, the bathrooms are very, very nice. Tell me you wouldn't
just grab some towels and sleep in the tub. I would be
Bob's kind of large.
Well, yeah, but I'm 6'6", but the shower to me was impressive. I mean, because I could stand up in it and not worry about hitting my head, which I can't say for many bathrooms. And I mean, but just the little touches in the Waldorf. I mean, you know, they put out slippers for you and they tell you the weather report and, oh, it's going to be raining tomorrow, so here's an umbrella.
Yeah.
Like, wow, that was cool.
It's really nice. Yeah, the service is just incredible. I think I checked in at like 2:00 in the morning when I was staying there. And you know, all the restaurants had closed or whatever, and so I asked them, do you have anything open 24 hours where I can get, you know, like something hot, because it was December and I was, you know, cold. And they're like, no, but we'll go get you something if you want. Like, really? From where are you going? I'm like, oh, we'll go to the Hilton next door. Okay. So, and they did. So, you know, they actually have 24-hour room service, but that's where they go get it. But yeah, it's really nice. I mean, the level of service there is incredible. Yeah. Have you guys stayed at the Ritz-Carlton?
No.
I wish.
Okay. The crazy nicest resort in all of Orlando is the Ritz-Carlton, by far. Really? Have you never been to the spa? Then I take it.
Mm-hmm. No, not there.
The spa is actually one of the best spas in North America.
Huh. Okay.
You should go to the spa.
This is the Ritz-Carlton on what is it? John Young Parkway.
Yeah, it's by the Rosen. Yeah, it's by the Rosen. SeaWorld.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Steve, are you taking notes?
A, the best hotel in Orlando. B.
Yeah, this is for my birthday.
You know, I think I took the bar exam at the Ritz-Carlton now that I think about it.
That's too funny.
Yeah. Or the Rosen right next door, yeah. So
yeah. It's the Rosen. That Rosen's not bad at all. And it's not the same level as the Ritz-Carlton, but
I don't know. They had a nice conference room.
it's not bad. But the Ritz-Carlton is the nicest. I mean, the service is just incredible there. The spa is, we actually rank the spas. We have a whole chapter on spas, and we do spa research, formal spa research every year. And the Ritz-Carlton always comes out number one. It's better than anything on Disney property by far.
Spa research. God, I want this job.
Everyone says hotel. So we do spa research. We send people to do, it's the same core group of people. And two of them go to each spa, and they rotate getting massages, facials, manicure, pedicure.
Well, they just rode Space Mountain for like 3 days in a row, Chris.
So here's the interesting thing, right? So we send people to do all this, you know, and again, it's the same group of people, so we're all consistent in what we're ranking. Everyone thinks it's a great job until the time somebody lost an eyebrow. She was so remember at Gaylord Palms, they used to have Canyon Ranch there.
Okay.
Somebody at the Canyon Ranch screwed up an eyebrow waxing and turned the heat on the wax up too high, so that when they applied it, it actually burnt one of our researchers' eyebrows off. Ooh. It burned her skin and everything. And which was, you know, I guess those things happen, right? That's sort of It's an occupational hazard. But the interesting thing from our perspective was the Canyon Ranch's response. First, they denied that it ever happened, which is like, okay, do you want to see the burned skin? Because we've got photos. So we called them back the next day and we said, look, you know, she's a researcher for the Unofficial Guide. This is what happened. You know, what are you guys doing in this situation? What, you know, because now it's a customer service issue. How do you handle it? And you know, we were asking questions. And they're like, well, we'll give her, you know, 50% off her next spa visit.
Wow. Like, generous.
She's not coming back. What
response were we? So that it's even. You know.
So the funny thing was, we put it in the book exactly as it happened. I mean, you know, no embellishing, like, you know, just fact-based. This is what happened. This is what we did. This is what they said. You know, and now actually,
I'm sure you were careful to do it that way.
We were actually. We have lawyers, but the Canyon Ranch actually closed. There's no longer a Canyon Ranch there. There's still a spa, but it's not a Canyon Ranch anymore. And the funny thing was, is we learned later it wasn't actual Canyon Ranch employees staffing it. It's like they had licensed it. Because we ended up talking to Canyon Ranch later. We're like, guys, what? You know, Canyon Ranch has a fantastic reputation there, and I've been to the Canyon Ranch in Vegas, and it was the best spa experience I've ever had in my life. So we're like, dude, what's going on there? And apparently, it wasn't actual Canyon Ranch employees there. It was staffers from the Gaylord Palms that were wearing the name tags. That's what I heard. It may or may not be true, but that was what happened. I kind of see that.
How is the Gaylord Palms as a resort?
It's big. It's huge. If you can get a rate of under like 150 a night, it's a bargain. It's very, very big. But the rooms aren't bad actually. It's a decent deluxe. It's not, you know, again, it's not the Waldorf. It's not the Hilton or anything like that, but it's not bad.
It was about a year ago. They had a special for like 129.
We've been a couple times just for the buffet over there and to walk around the inside kind of grounds that they
huge.
Have. Yeah, it's really nice.
Yeah, it reminds me of Vegas.
You know, we could probably ask a million questions, but we don't want to keep you, you know?
That's fine.
Oh, Lauren, don't you have a question? Oh, you're going to make me ask that question?
I'll ask him. I don't care. I'll ask him. But just to be kind of funny, Len, we have a debate, I guess, going on on the podcast as far as, you know, Duffy the Bear. because, you know, Chris and I hate him. I personally want to I have to resist the urge to go up and sucker punch him.
Wait, you do not resist the urge. You've drowned him.
The Duffy the Bear question?
So this is a Duffy, and Lauren just loves him, thinks he's just the cutest thing ever. So, I mean, I think he's a huge marketing ploy on the part of Disney. I mean, brilliant, but, I mean, just like, you know, a ripoff of like Build-A-Bear. You know, so, you know, are you Duffy or are you anti-Duffy?
If you're not anti-Duffy, I'm burning my unofficial guides, just so you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's pressure. You've already
paid for it. It depends on the mood. I mean, you know, if I'm being cynical, I'm like, that's a stupid idea, and I hate that they do it, and they're just doing it because people like it. That being said, I had my picture taken with Duffy like 100 times.
See?
But in an ironic way, like, ooh, me and Duffy, you know, to the point where now I actually like it. So, I got to say, I'm pro Duffy.
Yay!
I know. It's just wrong,
really,
isn't it?
Sad.
I know.
It really
They're going to kick me off the book. They're going to kick me off the book.
I bet Jim Hill is anti-Duffy. We'll have to get him back on the show.
No, see, Jim, I guarantee you, Jim would take his picture with Duffy just like I did.
Well, we all took our picture with Duffy, but we sort of hated it the whole time.
It was a bad experience for Chris.
It's not that I hate Duffy. I hate the people who came up with Duffy. Duffy, you can't blame him, right? It's not like Duffy spontaneously.
Oh, I think you can blame Duffy.
No, you can't blame him. It's like blaming Donald Duck for a bad cartoon.
Yeah.
That's good to know. You made Lauren's day.
Don't hit on the bear, man. Don't hit on the bear.
I bet you've never been asked that question either. So you know, actually, it's kind of unique.
That's a good one. I was a little scared where you're going with that. But.
You know what? You never know on this show where they're going.
I have this great picture of my daughter with Duffy, and it's kind of funny because she was not sure about Duffy, you know, too. She thought, you know, again, marketing player or whatever. But I think when she hugged Duffy and got the I Hugged Duffy sticker in Disneyland, she was a convert. So awesome, guys.
Almost warmed my heart. Almost.
Well, that's hard to do. Thanks for having me on the show anyway.
It's hard to warm Chris's heart, so don't feel
bad.
It is.
That's actually pretty impressive.
Usually I say that would warm my heart if I had one, but, you know.
she's like the Grinch from, you know, with the Who's and Whoville.
I know. Love that show.
I have to say, though, I absolutely love Touring Plans, and I recommend it to everybody.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, I don't think I plan a vacation for someone without recommending at least the crowd calendar. You have to use the crowd calendar. That's like incredibly useful. So, you know.
And lines.
That's going to wrap it up for this week's show. Thank you to pixievacations.com for sponsoring this podcast. We also want to thank Len for joining us. That was very, very informative. You can download our shows at mousechat.net and also from iTunes. Please send any of your comments and questions to comments@mousechat.net. Please join us again here next time on Mouse Chat.
Well, thanks again for having me, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for coming on.
I really appreciate it.